I refuse to hate myself in any way. And I think that is a massive shift, because when you start to see things like my neck went and wrinkles and stuff, and you start seeing them and it's horrific because we're told it's horrific.
Yeah.
I'm just so sick of seeing all these ironed similar faces and the, oh, it just breaks my heart a bit. And I just hope there's a backlash and a women reclaim their aging as an amazing gift, because what's the alternative? Be great and be loud.
Welcome to Psychologically Speaking with me, Leela Ainge. I'm a psychologist and coach exploring the way our beautiful minds work. In this new season, I'm working with a phrase that I've challenged my clients to embrace this year: expect the unexpected. And perhaps you had an event or an experience that did not go to plan. Perhaps there was something wonderful or serendipitous that came about as a result. I'm really intrigued and curious about what happens when life throws us a curveball, but more so what happens when we let that happen. I'm delighted to introduce Emma Seville, the voice and founder behind Your Menopause Toolkit. She's got a Substack and a coaching practice rooted in evidence-based insight, lived experience, and a generous dose of wit and feminism. Emma is a peri to post-menopause coach, nutritional therapist, and the creator of the Happy Healthy Menopause Framework. So she brings together feelings and food and movement and sleep. And I really like her framing that it's much more about agency and understanding what's happening in our body rather than powering through. So Emma, before we get into it, let me just say that menopause is probably a large constituent of my own unexpected moments of the last 5 years. So I was absolutely delighted when you said that you'd come on to talk about your unexpected moment. I do feel like menopause has a lot to answer for. We probably do give it a really hard time. Welcome, Emma.
Oh, thank you, Leela. What a beautiful start. Thank you. Yeah, my unexpected moment was about 4 years ago when I had a call from my letting agent to say that my landlady was going to sell
the
house. I'd been in with my daughter for 13 years, all of her life as solo mum in Bristol, and saw the repercussions of that and not realizing how difficult it was to find anywhere else to live, to the point where we were almost, you know, planning to go to my friend's house and sleep on her sofa. It was terrifying. I even had to go to homelessness prevention in Bristol City, which was the most dismal, sad place. It was a really traumatic time. But out of it, I've ended up somewhere, living somewhere else, somewhere that Edie could stay at the same school halfway. She was halfway away from it before, and now we're the other side of it. And I have a garden and a dog. And
we're going to talk about Peanut the dog, because it's just gorgeous. Emma, tell us a little bit about your pre-move days at Bristol and who you are and where life's taken you.
Yeah, so before I was doing massage and reflexology from the back room in the house that we lived in before, as well as building up my menopause business and nutritional therapy, kind of as a wellness coach, sort of, you know, trying to get some one-to-one clients. And then, you know, I was working on a website, it was all kind of planning it. I loved doing the massage, felt it very calming for me. Mm-hmm. As well as for the clients, had a nice little client base. Obviously, we had COVID,
so that
messed with things a bit as well. And then, Edie was very happy. She was getting the bus to school. She had lots of friends living really close by. I had lots of friends, quite supportive friends living close by. As a solo mum, like, you need those people. So it was all good. The next door neighbours were really probably quite close to as bad as you could wish for. So I always bring myself back to that thought. If I miss it, I'd made the house my own. I loved, you know, I decorated every room. I changed everything that I was allowed to change. It was, you know, it was a real home, and it was Edie's home. We had a cat that we loved very much who owned the street. And I used to run nearby, I used to go to the gym nearby, I used to start lifting weights. I was really, you know, I had a really solid existence.
Yeah.
And I always had a slight feeling that one day the house, you know, we'd lose our house. And I was also becoming aware of the changes in renting and how it's now kind of you have to earn three times the rent, and the rent had doubled over the time we'd been there. So I was always a little bit scared of it happening. But it was at the end of November. It was practically a month before Christmas Day when I had the phone call. And they give you a month's notice.
It's not a lot for them.
No. It was a shock. And also they gave the job of telling me to the youngest person in the office. And I just burst into tears and I felt so sorry for her. Like, why have you told? She just didn't know what to say. She didn't really say any of the right things. Yes, it was all a bit crashing down. And you know, the responsibility for making sure that Edie was happy, that was massive. So There was this long time. It felt like, oh, looking back, it feels like an incredibly long time where I was just paddling. I also have to say that during this time, my mum was dying. My mum was at end of life in an old people's home.
And what was your mum's name?
My mum's name, Mary.
Mary.
Yeah. So I was kind of dealing with that as well. It was just, she was just fading fast. And she actually passed away a week to the day before we literally moved into our house here.
I just want to take a moment to kind of say that's such a huge thing to have happened.
Yeah.
On top of another big, like we say these big life events, you know, grief, losing a parent, midlife, which you're in, and, you know, that uprooting of home. You know, home is so central to our safety and well-being and part of our identity. You know, you talk about your connections and your community. It was that identity.
Yeah, it was absolutely massive. I do think sometimes it was a bit so traumatizing that I wonder if I have a bit of PTSD from it, because I'm now, although I love where I am, and when we moved in, it wasn't finished. Mm. So we were going to move in at the beginning of January. And I'd already said, I can't leave this house until I found somewhere else. And I worked out that they can't force you out.
No.
But it got to that kind of point of having those discussions, which I didn't want to have. And then, you know, really advocating for myself in a way I hadn't ever had to do before.
Example of that, Emma. So, I mean, I was quite intrigued, really. Looking back now, it's probably easier to think about how you did actually cope, but it sounds like advocacy was a bit of a coping mechanism at the time.
Yeah, I think I just found myself having discussions and going into this incredibly sad place full of literally homeless people. And, you know, security guards walking around in staff-proof vests and staff crying in the corner because they couldn't help people.
Yeah.
And I walk in and I look so middle class. And so, you know, I know I look like people are looking at me, what the hell are you doing in here? And it's like, because it's happening to everybody. And the lady that helped me said, oh, I've just had a 65-year-old guy who's lived in his house all his life. His wife's died and they want to sell it. And he can't afford to rent anywhere else.
Yeah.
He's in the same position as you and they haven't got anywhere to send him. There aren't any, you know, that kind of tragic. So I thought, well, you know, I'm young and I've just felt like the whole system was heartbreaking. It was all heartbreaking. And then having to go into town, I went to a meetup, like one of the lovely, it was real work actually. It was a meetup. And then I had to leave early to go to the homelessness prevention office from this lovely world of privilege to this, you know, what was actually happening in my life.
That's such a stark contrast. So you're talking about, I mean, Real Work is a space created by Fleur Emery. And I would characterise that space as being full of quite very privileged individuals, you know, people who have time as a resource possibly and have some money, but also have moved through life and perhaps have some financial security. Potentially to help.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but then it is interesting, isn't it, how we can sit on the outskirts of different social groups and we can be in two different identities at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so opposite worlds.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's kind of where I sit in life, really. From the outside view, I'd be a very middle class, you know, health conscious, able to sustain healthy living.
Mm.
get enough sleep, all those good things, have a garden, talk about my greenhouse, albeit third hand, and all that. And then on the other hand, it could just crumble at any minute. And I'd be back to that point of, you know, sort of thing. Yeah, it was quite a mad day that. I remember walking around.
You'd gone to the real work meetup.
Yeah.
And then off to see the officer.
Yeah, this big space. And it's one big, great big room in an office block in the centre of Bristol. It's a council, part of the council offices. And yeah, it's just, we'd been in this really nice bar that was quite new and cool. And I had my nice denim jumpsuit thing on. Yeah. I remember walking around there and then trying to find my way in, not knowing where I was going. And then I went to the wrong desk. And nobody's particularly patient because they're all overworked. And yeah, it was massively. And I thought no one I know will ever be in this situation either. No, yeah, I hope. But the people I knew weren't probably.
It's interesting you should say that, isn't it? Part of my background, I worked with a charity where we supported people who were experiencing homelessness.
Yeah.
So it was over two decades. Well, gosh, yeah, it probably was 2 decades ago. Yeah, giving away my age. But at the time, the advocacy work that was happening there was very much going into corporates and saying to the people who wanted to help, do not believe for a moment you are different from,
no, exactly,
from these people. You know, we are all 3 months away from homelessness. That was, you know, quite a while ago. And I wonder now whether the precariousness has changed because cost of living is so expensive now. Yeah. It's proportionally more expensive. And people leaving university now leave with higher debt levels. We're hearing a lot about that in the news at the moment. Mm. So if you think maybe 15 years ago, it was 3 months you needed to stay stable. It's probably, you know, you could probably just have 6 months of stability and still find yourself really struggling.
Yeah.
With the precariousness of, you know, temporary housing.
Yeah, yeah. And more houses are being made into Airbnbs and to less. Yeah. And then more, it's just all going a bit bananas.
It does feel really strange. And I think we all feel that we drive around and you see lots of housing being built. But there are people who don't have that safety or security of a place to call home that they know they're going to be secure in for 6 to 12 months at a time. So tell me a little bit about how you moved through then. We've met you at a point where obviously you're writing it, you've got your month's notice, you're bargaining in your own head or even with your agents as think, you know, they can't chuck me out, I need to find somewhere else to go. So that bargaining stage is happening.
Yeah.
But presumably something does happen because we now know that you are in a space and you've got a new place. So how did that unfold?
Yeah, so I was asking everybody, I posted on the local Facebook groups, I was sort of really looking locally.
Yeah.
And stuck in that idea. And then my friend, so I now live in Portishead, which is along opposite Wales. So the Bristol Channel goes past. So it's very nice to be able to walk the dog along the coast path. And my friend, one of my old friends moved here because her mum lives quite close by. Mm. She wanted all her children to be able to walk to school. And we'd been to see them a few times. And we used to come up in the car and park up and walk along the coast path before we even had the dog, Edie and I, and think, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we lived here? Because I do love fresh air. I'm quite a country girl at heart.
Yeah. I love being
outside. And then my friend just said, actually, one of my neighbours has just done up a cottage attached to her house. I don't know how big it is. It's really tiny, but I'm not sure if it's 2 bed or 1 bed. So I said, okay, I do think for my sanity, I need a separate bed. I think we can do small, but I do need my own room, like, basically. And I wrote to my landlady and I got my pen out and my paper out and I wrote her a letter and I described us and I said I'd been living in the same house 13 years, always paid my rent and, you know, we would love your house and look after it, blah, 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 blah. And then she wrote me back and she just said, we are going through letting agent, Emma. And my heart just fell because I knew I wouldn't fulfill the criteria. as in having enough money in their eyes to rent it, because even though it's so small, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
But then one of my friends stepped up and said she'd be a guarantor.
Wow.
Out of the blue. So I could rent it. And that's what the greatest thing ever was, that she said that. And I have had a guarantor for years, and my sister's been a guarantor in the past. It was kind of been on low wage, scraping by. But that meant we could. So then I like dressed up as I thought of my friend would dress, who lives in Clifton. It's like the posh part of Bristol. I was like, right, idiot, we're going into that, and I'm telling them I'm renting that place. I'm not asking them. And then it's another out-of-body moment. I walked in, I went, we want to rent this house. What do we need to do? And I sat down. And then we talked to a lovely letting agent. It's a really nice letting agent, actually. And he said that my landlady is really special. She is really special. I love her to bits. And he wanted someone really nice to move in there to look after her, because she's quite old. And he was asking me all these questions about what I earn, and it was all really dismal and bad. It's so small that it wouldn't even, you know, it was kind of embarrassing to have that conversation. But then I said, but my friend will be a guarantor. So I think it, you know, and then he was like, okay, we don't need to know anything else. I just need her details. And then we could move in. And then it was, I got everything ready. I rang all the utilities. I sorted everything out over like 2 days. I started packing. I filled the back room with boxes. And then we got a message to say the house won't be ready in time. We've got to put it back a month. And then I couldn't work for that month because I'd filled the back room with boxes. My mum was in Bristol, so I was visiting her all the time. So it was all going on in the background. And I was just packing and packing and trying to keep everything okay at home with Edie as well. And you know,
so how does she take the move? So how old is Edie?
She's 16 now, so she must have been 13 when we moved. My friends got a daughter her age, and they were in primary school in year one together, and they absolutely loved each other, and they still love each other. And she just lives up the lane.
And she's still got a connection.
Yeah, this huge connection. So lucky. And when we came to visit this place, it was a building site, but we came to Cran and said, you could come and have a look if you like. Said, yes, please. And we walked in, and out the back, there's this amazing view. And we were so stressed. And there's the thing about looking at the horizon down, doesn't it? And we just, both of us looked out of that window, and we both went, look at the view. And it was from her bedroom window. And it was just like, you know, it was just, we loved it. And she's quite a country girl at heart. When we moved in, for a good few months, she kept saying, I can't believe we're not going to go home soon. It feels like we're on holiday and we're going to go home. We're going to have to go home. And I think the neighbours, as I said before, where we lived before, were just made life really difficult. They were awful. And we were always a little bit on edge. And I think we moved here and all that went, we only realised how much we were on edge with them. There were loads of good things moving here. I think for her, it's difficult. I think it's harder now in a way, because she wants to be able to reach her school friends. And they are it's a good hour away to get into Bristol. So she's missing out a bit. But she's doing sixth form here. And then I hope she will make friends locally. So that will be all right. She's got a job in the, you know, they call it the village. It's a little town. So there's lots of good things. I think for me, I've really hunkered down. I think when the grief and everything, I've just thrown myself into work and making the house nice. And for a long time, the garden was a therapy for me, because it was just, they just laid turf on top of rubble. Oh. So I dug up the turf thinking I'd put plants in. No. I had to dig out tons and tons of rubble. So it was like this whole labour of love. But it continues.
We often say, don't we, as coaches, that getting perspective on situations is such a helpful thing for us to do. Mm. And it's seen as such a mental task, like conceptually, that we should try and move our mental perspective, but you've physically changed perspective. You know, your perspective out of your window has literally changed. Yeah. And you're describing the impact that made almost instantaneously of lifting spirit.
Yeah, it really did. And we were very overlooked because we were in a little Victorian rail worker cottage kind of cottage in Bristol. And it was on a hill, so we were overlooked from behind and in front. There was no feeling of being in the garden and, you know, feels different, even though we're not really aware of it. Like, you can still enjoy being in your garden, but didn't feel like we could stay. I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? Whereas here, I might see the neighbour's face pop up as she hangs her washing out. We'll have a nice little chat. And then, you know, there's no one else around. It's really different. Yeah, I mean, it's real. It's absolutely what we needed after all that. This couldn't. It could just be a bit bigger.
Want more room?
Always want more.
It's that thing, isn't it, that we always fill the spaces that we occupy?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it would happen. It would happen.
Exactly. There's a good loft.
You mentioned that you really hunkered down and threw yourself into your work. And so I think I first was introduced to you possibly through Real Work. Mm. That would have been during the COVID years, because that was when the original community ran. I know it's reopened recently. And so what has changed with your business since you've moved?
So I am now kind of aiming myself at corporate workshops online. So I have to be able to work from home because of the dog. Yeah. And I want to, I found out at the beginning of last year that I have ADHD. And then that was a huge, huge thing to find that out and realise I'm now on medication. I'm trying out some different things, I think. I did find it really, really hard to do any work to start with. I couldn't concentrate. I didn't know where I was going with it. I'd sit down to do and just do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole prevaricating and not being able to focus. Now I feel like I'm getting there. I'm with on LinkedIn. I'm trying to break that. And I've got some good responses. So I feel like there's a possibility there. And I have to be able to earn what I feel is a huge amount of money to make things work here and be able to pay the rent. And so my mum left me a bit of money and I'm basically living off that, which is not ideal because it would make a good down payment for a house and safety. And I'm really aware of the word safety. It's like, don't feel like there's any anymore.
Everything. So it's really helpful for us to think about the cost of ADHD and precariousness. Mm. There's a body of work that has been done by a brilliant psychologist who's quantified the cost of having ADHD over the life course. Yeah. And for various reasons, you know, around executive function and ability to remember to pay subscriptions and bills and, you know, all of the stuff that, you know, if you look on social media, it tells you this is classic ADHD. That's a different conversation, but there is evidence that, you know, the precariousness that comes and the financial instability that comes with that. And it also then makes me think of Senil Mullanathan's work, and he wrote the book Scarcity. Mm. And he's an economist, but he talks about the behavioural economics that exist when we don't have as much in our pocket as the person next to us, and about the cost, the cognitive cost of having to make different decisions, because it's that exhaustion or tiredness that comes from having to always make a decision based on having less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that. That's so interesting. I'd love to read that. I think that's been the story of my life. At the moment, I'm going to a gym, which is a small group training gym, because I find lifting weights is just so lovely for my nervous system. And I'm getting really strong, but it's really expensive. And every day I have a panic about spending this money on it.
Really?
Yeah, every day. And I think other people, I'm like, how do the other people manage to go here? And I must stop going. I've got to go to Pure Gym. This is ridiculous. I need to go to the cheap gym. But I tried the cheap gym and I found it terrifying and overwhelming and too busy. And it got me in such a panic. I couldn't cope with it.
So there's two opposite things going on there as you're talking. So one of them is the affordability choice, is the what can I afford to do? Yeah. And the other competing thing there is the
where am I safe to do what I want to do? Yeah. And where do I belong? And there's never an easy answer with those things. We all have to make difficult choices. But if you're someone's having to repeatedly and consistently make the difficult choice that erodes the safety, belonging, and community that brings you peace,
yeah,
then that is the definition of precariousness, I suppose. And that doesn't help when you have ADHD, because you lose what you need to thrive. I want to just pick up on something you said earlier, which was, you know, I have to charge what I think is a large amount of money.
Or I have to earn what I think, yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's this, Sennell would say, he would say, depending on where we sit in our viewpoint, our perspective on money changes. So what feels like a lot. And that's why we find it difficult to charge as women. Sometimes is because obviously we've been used to that inequity and pay levels, you know, it's entrenched. But then if you think about the type of career that you've had, so you've done therapy. Therapy charges by hour, usually for manual, I'm guessing you charge by service.
Yeah.
And so there's quite a lot of mindset stuff there, isn't there, around valuing time versus hour, rather than stepping into the what knowledge and overall benefit.
Yeah, overall hours, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard because I think when I've definitely got the superpower of picking up on other people's feelings or disappointment.
Mm.
I don't know if that just comes from living with it all your life or especially as a child and being a disappointment or whatever. If I feel like that, and I know what's going through people's heads often, they're just like, where can you earn that much an hour? Did it? You know, and there's not much other thought going on if people haven't worked for themselves or they haven't done that and they don't get it. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know. Yes, yes, I'll do it cheaper. It's fine, it's fine. And I keep getting that scenario. Just, I don't know how to get past that, really. I don't know. Because I'm 55 and I've been feeling like this all my life. It's quite difficult, I think. Maybe if you got diagnosed when you were, and I sort of hear women of 30 saying, I've just been diagnosed. And fair enough, that's 30 years.
Mm.
I'm also like, I've been through all these life stages and all these things. And the thing I've never been any good at is earning enough money. But I'm not in any debt. I don't owe anyone any money. And I didn't, but even before I got my mum's money, I didn't owe anyone anything. I'm very good at kind of knowing what's in the bank and not overspending it. Apart from having a credit card in my 20s when you could get the 0% every month and then pay it off. And I did that and it was fine. And I'm still, like, I have at the moment got this bit of money and I'm not enjoying it. I'm not having a nice time of feeling safe because it's there. I'm just scared because it's disappearing so fast. And, you know, I'm like, I saw some Sambas, you know, those shoes everyone's got. And I was like, oh, they're so lovely. And I tried them on and I thought, I just can't buy those. This is the time in my life when actually I could buy them. But I feel quite alone in all that, in those decisions, because they're new decisions. And I'm not sure what to do for the best. And I'm buying Edie riding lessons because she's always wanted to do that. They're expensive. She does dog agility with the dog. That's quite expensive. But I feel like those are positive. I want her to learn to drive.
Yeah.
Get all these things sorted. But then the gym money, I'm like, she could have that when she's at uni and that would make so much difference to her. I'm being really selfish. I shouldn't be spending this. It's like a constant.
And you know, that's what scarcity talks about. It talks about this constant mental load of making decisions that are ultimately all financially based.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, we never know what other people are thinking, what other decisions they have to make around their own personal circumstances. You know, you could have two people in the room, they could both be in the same financial state, and one person just might not think things through, and the other person might think things through a lot. So there's so much difference in the way that we all process stuff. But the interesting thing for me is just, you know, how you've developed and evolved your business and your approach and everything you're doing around the menopause toolkit is so interesting to me, especially as you're looking at, you know, this kind of
whole period as well of menopause. And there is so much negativity about it.
No.
You know, it's really hard to escape all the negative stuff about menopause. So I wonder if you might give us a moment to let's put some positivity back into life transition. And, you know, you said it there, if ever there was a time, this is now. So if this is our time, if you're listening and you are menopausal or peri or post.
Yeah, in the menopause transition, I like calling it the menopause transition because it doesn't stop on the day of menopause, which is a year without period. People still get symptoms after that quite often for a little while. I think the best thing about menopause is finding your feet, finding your voice, finding yourself, expressing yourself in a way you probably never did before. It's like an out-of-body experience. Now, I stand up for other people. I stand up for, and I was such a people pleaser. And all of that going out of the window is just a blessing. Because you've got a lot more life left, you know, and it's sold to us like this terrible ending. And it's not an ending, it's the start of a new time, as Kate Codrington talks about it in such a beautiful way. And it really is, it's like the opportunity to figure out what doesn't serve you and what is really annoying you, because those things are telling you something. Like if somebody's taking you for granted, if somebody's continually leaving their pants on the floor or their you won't be able to stand it anymore, and that's good. You don't want to be picking them up until you're 80.
And it's a bit like you've just got a crystal ball and looked into my house. You're always leaving their pants on the floor over here.
Yeah, you'll be like, right, I'm not washing them, they're going in the bin. You have no pants, how funny. Yeah, I think it's just this time of like women raging up, and it's great. And you know, all the activists, when you look at all the Just Stop Oil and those women with grey hair up on the bridges and stuff, they're all older women having
being so active and this agency thing. But I wonder if I could share something with you. So I've had this like kind of gradual, I don't know whether it's like creeping recognition that there's less time left, and it sounds so weird to say it, but I don't know when I looked at myself almost like if I'm putting my life course out on a piece of string. Mm. And I used to think, oh God, I'm not near the middle yet.
Yeah.
Now I sit here almost like just on the middle and I can see to the end now. And it feels, I don't know. I don't know whether this is just like the beginning of me reframing that and working through it. But I do worry it's affecting a lot of where I make decisions at the moment, because I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I am suddenly becoming a little bit fearful that I'm not doing all the strength training that everybody else seems to be doing. And I'm going, I really need to start that, but I know I don't enjoy it.
No, do what you enjoy. Exactly. There's ways to do stuff.
Yeah. But it's really weird how this crept. So the hormonal side really just landed overnight for me and shook me.
Yeah.
And, you know, the anxiety was absolutely crippling. Somebody who'd never had anxiety before. And then menopause made life really challenging for quite a number of years. And it coincided with having a toddler. So it was just horrific, you know. Mm. And I'm through that bit. But now I think I'm just at this place where I think it's the identity bit of me that's catching up and going, I'm in this new place. You know, I've retrained. I'm doing a PhD and all the positive stuff happened. But now I'm kind of in this, oh my God, but I wish this had all happened 10 years ago.
I know.
I was younger. It's like a
reckoning, isn't there? It's like a reckoning. And you do realise that you're mortal.
Yes.
I completely get where you're coming from. I was thinking about it the other day, and I was just thinking about my daughter and how she sees the future as endless and vast. And of course, you know, you should. But then you do reach an age, like 50 or something, where you're like, oh, it's not. And I can see it on my face. And I think there's that whole, you know, the side of it that it really intrigues me is how we're told not to enjoy our aging faces, and so hard to fight that. I had a mammogram the other day. This might be too much information. I had a mammogram the other day, and if you've got very firm boobs, a mammogram's quite painful, really. It's verging on painful. But mine is so, like, not firm now.
It was fine.
I'd like, oh, look at them. And I could see my boob on the plastic, the perspex, perfectly clean perspex. And this was like matte squish, like the squish of it. I was like, wow, look at you. You're made for this. And I don't mind. I'm like, you've lived your whole lives, you little boobies. And you've done all the feeding and the, you know, they've had their time. They've fulfilled all their objectives. I refuse to hate myself in any way. And I think that is a massive shift, because when you start to see things like my neck went and wrinkles and stuff, and you start seeing them and it's horrific because we're told it's horrific from every angle of, you know, everything. But I'm just so sick of seeing all these ironed similar faces and the... It just breaks my heart a bit. And I just hope there's a backlash and a women reclaim their aging as an amazing gift, because what's the alternative? Be great and be loud.
You're not saying hello. I think one of the things that I've enjoyed over the last couple of years is, you know, obviously Pamela Anderson doing her iconic "I'm not going to wear makeup." I mean, I'm sure she is wearing that makeup, but hats off, you know.
Yeah,
she wears a lot less than I do. Yeah. When I go out. So, and I think because she was such an iconic, perfect body image as well for us.
Yeah, so cool. It, yeah,
it's been so lovely to see her age.
I know.
And then I love the voices of the poet Holly McNish as well.
Yes,
younger than me, but because she's written about being a mum after I've experienced it, I now read her poetry and think, oh, I wish I'd read that.
Yeah, I know, they were
amazing. So I'm actually seeing her in Nottingham.
Are you?
Yes,
I looked on World of Books the other day for lobster. I want lobster, but maybe I should look for slug. It's slug, isn't it?
Slug's a really good one.
They're all great.
They're good books. You can get loads of them secondhand as well, which is really nice.
That's what I in fact, my daughter wanted to get me something. What was it for? I can't remember now. I feel like there was a date. Mother's Day coming up, isn't there? And I said, that's what I'd like to have.
There you go.
And I leave books like that in the bathroom in hopes that she'll pick them up. Because I just can't. The thought of her going through all that. I mean, she's starting to feel those things now, looking
at the consumption of the aesthetic. And, you know, we've got this whole kind of post injection world as well, which is, you know, it's a very personal choice, and everybody's body is their own. If that's your choice, that's your choice.
Yes, quite.
It's the objectification of it and on social media and the positioning of it as a triumph of input and being perfect, which I struggle with.
Yeah, quite. You've put it so well. Yeah, that's exactly right. Heartbreaking. And it's also probably not good for us. Especially as if you're an older woman, it you kind of eating up your own muscle because you don't want to eat any food.
Yeah.
Oh, it just scares me as a,
We don't know what the long-term impacts are.
No, but they know that you're losing muscle mass, and that anyway, and as we age, we lose muscle mass anyway. Women lose quite a lot of muscle mass. That's why the whole build muscle, and you have to work towards building muscle. In whatever way.
I don't really stick with gardening for that. I do love being in the garden, but there's a lot of lugging stuff around. Yeah, and every time I'm lugging stuff and I feel achy, then Jay, I think, right, this is good. This is good for me.
Definitely. You've got to eat protein and you've got to really test your muscles and
exactly
where you want to do it. But yeah, I agree. I think that it really scares me. And the whole thinness thing. Edie tried on bought some jeans, and she didn't know about jeans. All the jeans in the world are different sizes, aren't they? It doesn't matter what's written on them. They can be from the same shop and they'll be completely different. And she just picked some up and then they were too small and she was actually devastated. And I just hug her and I'm just like, please don't let it get to you. Just don't. Try not to let it get to you. It's so sad. All of us women wasting all this time hating ourselves.
And so much we can just be doing, which is really positive stuff. So, I mean, you took the decision then at some point to move from reflexology,
to move into the menopause space, presumably. So that was that during COVID that transition took place?
Yeah, I think I'd studied the menopause course in 2017.
Oh, wow.
It was a year long. It's the Burrell course. And then I did the nutritional therapy one. So I always did, I was a massage therapist and a reflexologist, and you have to do CPD. So I thought, okay, I'll do these. And they were online, and it was quite new learning online then. And I just slowly kind of integrated it. And I'm always pivoting. I've realized there's a word for it. I'm pivoting again. And I'm doing my Substack, and I'm really enjoying writing, and I'm building a kind of membership on there. I'm still seeing one-to-one clients. But yeah, I think COVID definitely brought to light the need to be able to work self-sufficiently from home, you know. So that was the perfect time. And then moving here and losing the space to do the massage was the, you know, crux of it. I would still do massage. I think now I know about my nervous system, ADHD and everything. Yeah. Doing the massage is incredibly calming for me, and I really missed it.
It's an incredibly physical profession, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tough on your own body. Yeah.
Yeah. So your thumbs.
Yeah.
In the thumb joint.
Is that something you think you'll return to?
If I had a opportunity to, I'd like to do it for a day a week, but you know, it's so hard, isn't it, because you have all these ideas and it's like everything's possible, but actually I'm trying to make a quilt, and so far over the past month of trying to make a quilt, all I've done is iron some fabric.
Well done for the ironing.
Thank you. I don't do ironing, so that is quite big. Yeah, so I'm like kind of kidding. I know it's going to be slow, and I don't mind that. I've come to terms with the slowness. Mm-hmm. It's going to take years because I'm going to do it by hand. But yeah, I think I keep thinking maybe I could do it for one day. But actually the logistics of that are huge, because you still have to talk to clients. You have to be available to book in clients or talk to them. They don't want to use the booking system. You'd have to add it to your website. You'd have to, you know, if it's word of mouth, people just send you messages, and then you're there in the evening, back and forwarding. I used to forget to charge people because everyone was so relaxed at the end, and it was so nice. And they'd leave and they go, Emma, I haven't paid you. And then I used to have vouchers, and people would come, and then at the end they go, oh, I lost my voucher. There's a lot of things, you know, people are weird, aren't they? And I'd feel sorry for them. And then someone else would come with a voucher, and I'd think, that's your mate's voucher, isn't it? At some point they went, have this. And then either they forgot that they gave it to you, or they knew they were giving it to you, and they thought it was funny because they're not poor and they don't know what it's like. Or something, you just feel a bit, I don't know. So probably not. No, I don't know.
Maybe there's something about charging up front.
Yeah, charge up front. I know all those things. I've learned a lot of lessons, and maybe the menopause will help me be a lot more.
It was really interesting, because when I did consultancy work, I would invoice. So I'd do the work and invoice. And over COVID, I had one brilliant client who pretty much paid my mortgage that year.
Yeah.
But it was a 90-day payment term because they were American. And so when I put my invoices in, it was over 3 months later when the money came through. And something inside me just thought, I can't do this, not as a freelancer.
No, because that's going to pop in your head continually.
Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, I've got a limited company, but I wasn't working with a lot of people. So there was a couple of people I was working with, but not a lot. And I couldn't build my business into an agency at that point in time, which was the big dream at one point.
Okay.
So that's when I flipped, and I just charge up front for everything.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you pay and then you get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it has made things so easy.
Yeah.
It's not chasing people, because if they don't pay, they don't get it.
Yeah. I have some really solid T&Cs, don't I?
Yeah. I've got some really good ones, actually. So one of the really wonderful things that happened for me was getting my T's and C's done during COVID. And
was it? Yeah.
Yeah. Through wonderful, wonderful woman called Ingrid Fernandez.
Oh, I know that name.
Yeah. So she's been connected to Doing It for the Kids. And also, I think she was in The Real Work at some point.
Yeah.
So Ingrid did my terms and conditions, and yeah, it's just it makes life easy. It's like, yeah. And part of that also is being comfortable with the value of what I'm selling as well.
Yeah.
So I'm getting better at asking people, is this worth what you would pay, or am I undercharging? And interestingly, in my group experience this year, I asked the question, am I charging enough, not enough, or undercharging? And everyone said, you're undercharging. So I think getting real feedback and asking for it. And I'm a big advocate of using research in your own business office. Yeah. As a researcher, it's like, when have you last asked a client how did that feel in terms of value and in price? And I think we need to ask the question more often, because that's anti-people-pleasing, isn't it?
It's the opposite. But yeah. People don't mind either. I was like being asked things like that, because it's, you're kind of helping somebody, so you're people-pleasing by answering.
Yeah. I think it shows that you're engaged with people, because you're kind of saying, well, I value you being a customer, but let me understand how this is sitting for you as well. And sometimes, yeah, I have had clients that have left me along the way when prices have gone up, but yeah, then I've had new clients as a result. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it does help.
Yeah. And do you have flat rates for things that you do?
Yeah. Because I am researching part-time, I'm doing a PhD, so I've got a load of admin with that, and yeah, I don't need admin in my life. So I have got fixed rates for everything. So with my research, it's retainer rate, and it's the same rate for absolutely everybody.
Yeah.
Because right, it just keeps things simple. When I have finished doing the PhD and I've got a bit more time and I'm working with more clients and I can afford to have admin, yeah, I might revisit that. But for every single person who says, don't charge by the hour or don't do this, there's also somebody like me or you sitting there going, but my personal circumstances mean I just need simplicity right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got this thing with working for public sector versus private sector.
Oh, okay.
So I feel like public sector is obviously not quite the same as a tax deductible expense for a huge company. So I think
it's different though. So the way I would always, I worked a lot of my career in public sector, you know, they get specific pots of money for different things.
Yeah.
So they've usually budgeted for stuff more than a private company has. Usually trying to find money from a private company means somebody's got to go and find the budget from somewhere. For a public sector company, then the way I would think about it differently, if I wanted to shift away from time for money, is they know they want this, or they've got a budget. They've got a budget somewhere for it. So therefore, I'm just spending what they've got.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to charities as well, people who say, oh, charities can't afford it. Again, the whole point of charities and CICs is that they fund what they need. So they go and get the funding to do what they need.
Oh, I see. Employ people to do that, don't they?
So unless you're telling charities and CICs and public sector, here's my offering, here's what it costs, how do they then forward budget for that kind of thing? So I think it's a two-way thing. One, they might say no this year, but unless you've told them what the price is and not undersold yourself, how do they know next year to budget it? Definitely worked in a council where we have looked at budgeting something in the year after because we haven't got enough money in the budget the year before. We think about things from our perspective rather than the business's perspective sometimes. I'm not the expert on any of this. I think the Good Girl Economics research I did with Nikki is really interesting because we talk about stuff that stops women from charging their worth. But Sarah Dalrymple is doing some really interesting work at the moment on visibility. And she also talks about pricing as well. And I think all these people, they're all saying similar things from different perspectives, but it's very much, you know, you can charge and we shouldn't.
I've just done something so bad based on what you're saying that I'm now having. Yeah, I feel like I need to be hypnotized or something so I can actually say what I want to charge. It's not there, Peanut. Go and find it.
I suppose my question would be, do you know what you need to charge?
Yes, I've worked that out. But I'm not really running at capacity. I'm still getting jobs, drips and drabs, as it were, still sort of at the start of building it all.
And things take time, don't they? They take time.
What I think to myself is, if I was a 55-year-old man with grey suit, grey hair, grey Mercedes, you would not be saying no to paying me that much. You'd be like, great. That's what I have to, that's what I keep in my head. And they wouldn't be feeling bad about asking for the money, and everyone would be assuming they'd be worth that much money. And that, yeah, I feel like a completely different. And also, because I'm talking about women's health, it's not, you know, it's a different.
I mean, we know this. There's huge gaps. We know there's just limited funding for research on women's health. And really interesting, you know, the qualitative research is really lacking. So we've got data points that are starting to come through, like how many women are considered to be perimenopausal and taking CHAR-T, for example. We're starting to get, we've got data on that. But if you start looking at how many perimenopausal women have had unexpected moments that have brought them deep joy, we can't answer those questions. Nobody's talking about that. And yet we've had this lovely conversation today where there was this deeply kind of traumatic, probably, and distressing point in time where you lost home, mum, you know, community, those things. But deep joys come through there as well. You know, the garden, peanut the dog.
You know,
as we're talking, you've got the sun coming right through into your room. And
I know, it is lovely.
Beautiful. And yet, you know, things we value, like these life things that bring us deep joy, just they don't seem as sexy, do they, for the money?
No, it's just holding it. I just want to keep hold of it. I just want to keep hold of it. It's a lot. It's a lot for one person with a very low grasp of, what do you call it? The ADHD thing.
Executive function.
Executive function, yes.
Yeah. It has been recognised for the first time, I think, in the government send paper, where schools' executive function has been recognised as of yesterday as a domain in its own right. I still worry that perhaps the approach that government is taking is that we have to work to improve children rather than improve the space. But when you think about your life perspective, though, Emma, I think there's something really rich about the fact that you have had this unexpected transition in your menopausal years, that your perspective, that you deeply understand precarity. And I think I would totally be stepping into that. I think there are more women than not who reach their 40s and 50s and might not have a partner in life, or there have been changes, or they lose parents, they lose stability, they lose safety. And whenever I read your work, that for me is what comes through, certainly through Substack and stuff, is just your deep understanding of that. And that's that empath in you, I suppose.
There's big, too much empathy, as my daughter says. I'm crying over a hedge that's been chopped up. Yeah. Oh, thank you. My ADHD post, I wrote one called something about squirrels, and it was the best performing post I've done, because it's, you know, it's millions and millions of women, aren't there? And actually a health professional said to me, oh God, everybody, you know, it's ridiculous. Everybody's got ADHD. And I was like, what are you saying that to me for when I've just said it to you and you're working as a health professional?
That's not a very informed approach, is it?
No. I was like, yeah, it's not fun. I'm not getting anything out of it. It's not, yeah, but you do get stuff out of it, but it's like generally in this world, it's not designed for us. It's kind of makes life a lot harder. It's not.
We make assumptions, don't we, as humans? It's one of the wonderful psychological things about being human is that we can see a behaviour and we can relate to it. And therefore we think A plus A equals B, but it doesn't. It just equals AA.
Yeah.
And we see correlations where there aren't correlations, but it doesn't mean that anyone's life experience is less valid. I think the increase in diagnosis is helpful when is transformative for people. I think the increase in public knowledge about ADHD is very helpful. I think it just makes us, you know, a lot of the adaptations or support that can be put in for ADHD benefits so many people.
Yeah.
why wouldn't we all want to have more psychological safety would be my answer to anyone who says, well, everybody thinks that they've now got it. And I go, well, doesn't everybody deserve psychological safety?
Quite to feel okay about saying it. That's another thing about the menopause, is to be, you know, you just say it.
Yeah.
You just say it, whatever you need to say. I don't have any qualms about those. I really feel like if anyone's got a problem, it is theirs. It just shocks me that people would have one still, you know. So I'd say it in, I've read that people are frightened to say it in interviews or frightened to tell work that they do and things like that. It's just, I guess that comes from hearing people say negative things.
ADHD's been so tightly kind of bound to identity, hasn't it? Especially in media. And in that respect, I can see why it's either a very affirming or unsettling thing to confront or to work with. So for some people, it's a badge. It's kind of saying to people, this is who I am, and that's their identity I feel very comfortable with. Likewise, same person, same age, different circumstances, who's probably, you know, could be more precarious for them. They're thinking, this is, you know, destabilizing. It could be threatening. It threatens my safety or whatever. And I think this is where, as a social scientist, the identity piece is always so much more interesting than the diagnosis. It's, you know, what's your context? Where are you living? How are you moving through life? Who else is impacting these things? And I think when we lose perspective, that is really interesting. I'm going to leave you with something. I've been reading about Donna Haraway, and I'd never come across her at all, but she is a feminist historian, I think, or something. But she wrote some seminal kind of essays, and I came across her work as part of my PhD. She talks about the privilege of perspective.
And I've been, you know, it's only really recently I've considered privilege and you know, entitlement and all those things. Really never crossed my mind before. It's just like some people worked harder than others.
I have really enjoyed our talk, Emma, and I just want to say thank you, because you've shared some really difficult things with us and also some big life shifts and moments. You've spoken about Mum Mary, sorry to hear that she passed, and also I suppose a difficult house move. But it's also interesting then to hear about the unexpected moments and what happens when you sit with it, or you kind of lean into it as you did, and that agency you found around going, I'm going to get this house. So thank you.
I've really enjoyed it as well. Isn't it very enlightening? I'm looking forward to reading. Is it Donna?
Donna Haraway, yeah.
Haraway, yeah. Haraway. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for today. Thank you so much for listening to Psychologically Speaking. My name's Leela Ainge and I run The Reflection Room. We start next week with a series of weekly prompts and 3 workshops. Come and join us. The welcome event is available for everybody, and we're doing a live workshop with a prompt around rumination. For more details, visit www.leelaainge.co.uk. See you there.